So, Zen has always been a difficult topic to approach. The words used are very often contradictory. They don't match up with our ordinary way of thinking about the world. And it ends up being very, very puzzling for people, and then this particular practice will exploit that deep not knowing and that deep puzzling to push someone to go into their center, to ask in the most profound way, discarding every other idea and thought because it can't grasp this space until you come to some deep center. And then something becomes obvious and clear. Now, one thing you can say about this path is that the most extraordinary, mystical, impossible to explain, profound, mind-blowing fact is already completely achieved by each of us here, utterly achieved, originally achieved. The Buddha continually pointed this out. He said, "Truly, I gained nothing from complete unexcelled enlightenment. When I realized that I had always achieved it, I understood that this primordial Buddha, whose name was Dipankara Buddha, would not have made the prediction about me that I would become the Buddha of this era, in other words, the fully enlightened human being who brought this particular type of teaching to this era that we're in, that we're talking about right here and practicing, had I not already automatically, intrinsically, originally achieved that which is described by the words Anyutara Samyak Sambodhi, which is complete unexcelled enlightenment." So the Buddha said, "I had it originally." And the Buddha also said, "Isn't it an incredible, amazing thing that all beings have Buddha nature automatically?" And there are many koan about this in Zen. Does even a dog have Buddha nature? I mean, you have to understand in ancient China, where the koan came from, a dog was the most lowly. It would be like us saying, "Does even a rat have Buddha nature?" Something like that. That's how dogs were viewed, and still are viewed, actually, in the Orient. They're not pets like they are here. Does even a dog have Buddha nature? Now you notice that in this particular koan, Joshi didn't say, "Oh yes, he has Buddha nature." He said, "Moo!" Direct pointing. To say, "Yes, he has Buddha nature," is to create another idea, another concept. And this is really the difficulty. It's taking this mind that is so highly trained to utilize concepts and bring it into this space, this profound, real space, not the virtual world that we need to enter every morning after we brush our teeth and take a shower. Of planning, to-do lists, tasks, skill set, interactions, expectations, hopes, fears, and all the rest of it, which is the human realm, which we cannot abandon, but which hopefully this practice puts in a completely new perspective. So I think that these talks that are called Teisho, as difficult as they can be for this other mind to sink its teeth into, should be a genuine, heartfelt attempt to demystify, not to mystify. I've always tried to do this in these talks, and maybe I've succeeded at times and not succeeded at other times. And maybe it's because I'm mystified too. So anyway, I want to talk a little bit about this third mark of existence. We haven't talked much about this third mark of existence. So one of the things that the Buddha pointed out in his early teachings were what he referred to as the three marks of existence, the three marks of things that appear in front of you. One mark is dukkha, that's the first mark of existence, suffering. And we all know this, we don't have to go into it, we've gone into it many times before, it's obvious. You just have to turn on the news, stub your toe, have to go to work when you're too tired, all the rest of it, and you get that totally, 100%. And the fact that you look in the mirror, you say, oh my God, like I just turned 63. If I look in the mirror and I remember back, or I look at a picture of myself even 10 years ago, what happened to you? This is that first mark of existence. And the second mark of existence is tightly tied in with that. It's impermanence. So the first one is dukkha, the second one is anicca, impermanence. This is the first law of thermodynamics, of entropy. Everything is continually falling apart. And even when we put it back together, it continually falls apart again. And it continually changes in every moment. And even something that seems utterly fixed, like think of this thing that just seems so solid and fixed, the Washington Monument. You ever see that? This massive structure. Well, it's got a lot of cracks in it because there was an earthquake. And I thought about that yesterday when I was listening to it on the radio. So someday that thing's going to completely crumble to the ground. There will be nothing left of it. And that is an absolute fact. Anything you can imagine. Look at the pyramids crumbling. Look at the western part of Antarctica crumbling, melting. Everything's constantly changing. We want it not. When things are just the way we like them, we want to fix them. And that's an aspect of this dukkha, is that even when things are just seemingly wonderful and we just want to fix it, we can't fix it, we can't stop it from changing into something we don't want. So there's this impermanence. Both of these sides could potentially create the idea, both in the practicing Buddhist and someone looking at this practice from the outside, that this is a very negative, nihilistic, depressing path. Which it, of course, is not. Anyone who has practiced it deeply knows that it is not. It is nothing nihilistic or depressing about coming into accord with reality. Really clear accord. It's that embracing aspect of the practice. There's a very clear-headed, clear-eyed, unblinking view of reality. But it's never done with opposition, despair, resistance. It's utter embracing. If you know from the start that existence is dukkic, impermanent, then you won't create an idea in your mind, or you will gradually let go of an idea that is just not true. It'd be like horns on a rabbit, as they say. If it's just not true, there's no reason to create a template like that and hold it up against reality, which we can clearly see, particularly as we do this practice called Zazen, longer and longer. We're more and more able to kind of wipe the haze off the eyes and see things as they actually are. So this third mark of existence we haven't talked too much about. And this one is no self, or anatta, so no self. Now, in order to assert that there's no self and kind of demystify this side of it, we have to first understand what we mean by self, like what is meant by self. So self is something personal, circumscribed, divided off, with characteristics. There's something that is not self. If everything was self, there would be no point in even using the term self, that everything's self. So we're talking about the self that is divided off, circumscribed, separated out, maybe amongst other so-called selves, entities. They exist, they appear outside this self. Now they don't just include sentient beings, which we and ants and Buddhas and grasshoppers and dogs are, but self includes concepts and it includes objects. So for example, we see this thing here, it's called a watch. We have a name for it. That's part of what creates this self of this watch. So not only does it have a name, it has characteristics, and there are things that make it a watch and not a hammer. Its shape, its function, and we think it's out here, outside, and it somehow has stuffness to it. It's fixed. It's an entity. This is its selfness, okay? It has characteristics and it's outside me. It has itself. It's the self of watch. You can do that with a person, a pet, a concept, democracy, violence, vitamins, whatever you want to do, any of these things. We have thousands and thousands of words that define and split off and separate out these separated entities. And it's very, very useful. It helps us survive and it helps us manipulate the world and it protects us. It's extremely useful. But it is really like a skillful means. It's a designation that doesn't point at any actual self. Because you could ask yourself, where does the watch actually end and the rest of the world begin? So for example, if this watch's battery didn't come from the earth, and if there weren't other components here that were dug up and created into this, and there wasn't sun powering everything, there would be nothing here. And this is continually deteriorating, changing. If you looked at the surface of it, there are atoms and molecules and electrons that are leaving it constantly, and maybe others that are attaching to it. So what we call this is constantly changing. We can't find the exact border between it and the world. That's one side of it. The other side of it, is it out here? Does it have its own selfness? Is it out here? It's that old question, if a tree fell in the wilderness and nobody heard it, would it make a sound? What is a sound? What is a watch? What is a carpet? What is the smell of incense? Is there a smell of incense, if not for you yourself, in your deepest center? If you smell that incense, isn't that your incense smell? So where does that incense end and you begin? So where does yourself and that incense's self begin and end? And if they were separated entities, as everything in this world seems to be, how could there be any connection, any understanding, any perception of it? So these are the deep questions here. So what is this self? Now the Buddha said there is no self. There are no separated individuals. There are no personalities. There are no objects. Sixth Patriarch said from the very beginning, not a single thing has ever existed, stood outside. Not a single thing. Uh-oh, now I'm mystifying. Yeah, the mind can't quite grasp this. What does this mean? It's very useful to have these concepts and descriptions and to think of things as separated. Because in the morning I want to remember where I put this thing and put it on my wrist and snap it because I know it has a certain function. So I put it on my wrist and I wear it during the day and I call it a watch. And everybody else thinks it's a watch. But it's constantly changing in each moment, constantly moving. There's a sensation of it. That's my sensation. There's a view of it. That's my view. There's a meaning to this time that's unique to me. When I see 8:27, I'm thinking, I have another 20 minutes to give this talk. You're not thinking that. This is unique to me. Unique. There's no dividing line between it and me. I can't find that line. So maybe, is there no entity here. I have a body, I have thoughts, I have apparently a mind, but where does it begin and end? We've gone through this many, many times. How about an entity called enlightenment, achievement, suffering? All these concepts that split off an idea, all right? A concept, meaning something that you grab something with, to grab something with. Grab hold of an idea with this word, which then somehow has its own separated reality. It becomes solid. I can't see through it. And then it becomes something that I hold up as a comparison or as a value judgment. And then it turns into a discrimination. And we've seen very ugly examples of that lately by famous and very wealthy people. They're being caught by concepts and ideas. They seem so real to them, so solid that we see through it. But there are concepts that we're caught by, we're fooled by. So I thought I would go back to the originator of this modern day approach, the Buddha himself, and the words that were attributed to him in the Diamond Sutra, which is just an absolutely wonderful text. It's so profound. It's so spare. It's so stark. There's nothing like it in any other religion that I'm aware of, quite like this. I'm going to read you some of it right now. This is the Diamond Sutra. And incidentally, this is one of the oldest books in existence, printed books. If you go to the British Library and you walk up to a little case there and you look and you see this little sign, it says, oldest known printing. And then in little print, the Diamond Sutra. And when I saw that printed in Sanskrit, it just blew my mind. So anyway, let's read this section. This is section 9, and the title of this, there's many sections in this. They're very brief. They're only a few paragraphs long. And they each have a title. So the title of this is Real Designation is Undesignate. Remember what we were talking about. Start out with this idea of this third mark of existence, self. And the Buddha said, no self is the third mark of existence. No self, no designation, no concept, no thingness, no selfness, no separatedness. And here's what was written here. So Subhuti is one of the Buddha's elder disciples. And Subhuti is the kind of protagonist in this Diamond Sutra. He's the one that's asking Buddha the questions in front of thousands of bodhisattvas, monks, and they're in Deer Park. So Subhuti said, the Buddha asked Subhuti, because Subhuti also becomes the foil here, and the Buddha will ask him questions. So Subhuti, what do you think? Does a disciple who has entered the stream of the holy life, I think a better translation of this would be the stream of awakening, say within himself, I obtain the fruit of a stream entrant. So stream entrant, incidentally, is someone who has had a Kensho experience. And they call it entering the stream. It's a very wonderful description. Almost like a physical sensation when you've had an experience like this, of being a stream of ever-changing phenomena, not standing apart, but being the stream. You enter the stream, you walk in the stream, you swim in the stream, you drink the stream, you are the stream. This is this Kensho experience. So does a disciple who has entered the stream of the holy life say within himself, I obtain the fruit of a stream entrant. All right, think about what we said about no self and that concepts are to be held very lightly. They're useful, but they don't designate anything real. And Subhuti said, no, world-honored one, which is one of the appellations of the Buddha. Wherefore? Because stream entrant, and this is in quotes, stream entrant is merely a name. There is no stream entering. The disciple who pays no regard to form, sound, odor, taste, touch, or any quality is called a stream entrant. Pays no regard. Doesn't make it special. Doesn't name it. Doesn't create concepts about it. Subbuji, what do you think? Does an adept who is subject to only one more rebirth, say within himself, and this is in the Buddhist teachings there, especially in the Theravada school, we Zen is part of the Mahayana school, but in the Theravada school, they look at these various stages towards final nirvana. And one of them is only one more rebirth. You've reached this point where you only need one more rebirth to clear up certain attachments and blindnesses, and then you'll enter nirvana just like the Buddha. Subbuti, what do you think? Does an adept who is subject to only one more rebirth say within himself, I obtain the fruit of a once to be reborn? Subbuti said, no, world-honored one. Wherefore? Because, in quotes, once to be reborn is merely a name. There is no passing away, no coming into existence. The adept who realizes this is called once to be reborn. Subbuti, what do you think? Does a venerable one who will never more be reborn as a mortal say within himself, I obtain the fruit of a non-returner? Subbuti said, no, world-honored one. Wherefore? Because non-returner is merely a name. So think about this. Here's this, if you want to call it a religion, the highest attainments and aspirations of the followers are to reach these very high states. And the founder of this religion is saying it isn't even real. There's no such thing. Pulling the rug out from under even these very lofty, deeply held, heart-centered concepts, never to return, nirvana, enlightenment. Subbuti said, no, world-honored one. Wherefore? Because non-returner is merely a name. There is no non-returning. Hence the designation non-returner. Subbuti, what do you think? Does a holy one say within himself, I obtain perfective enlightenment? Subbuti said, no, world-honored one. Wherefore? Because there is no such condition as that called perfective enlightenment. World-honored one, if a holy one of perfective enlightenment said to himself, such am I, he would necessarily partake of the idea of an ego entity, a personality, a being, or a separated individuality. World-honored one, when the Buddha declares that I excel amongst holy men in the yoga of perfect quiescence, in dwelling in seclusion, and in freedom from passions, I do not say within myself, I am a holy one of perfective enlightenment, free from passions. World-honored one, if I said within myself, such am I, you would not declare. Subbuti finds happiness abiding in peace and seclusion in the midst of the forest. This is because Subbuti abides nowhere. Therefore, he is called Subbuti, joyful abider in peace, dweller in seclusion in the forest. Now, you notice something here. There is no such thing, but we use these words. Subbuti did not say these words are not useful. They don't point at something. But what they're pointing out really is not there as an entity, as something separated out. It's only indicating something, some direction, some reality to move in, not a thing to attain that you don't already have. This is a critical, critical point. We use these concepts, but we see them as concepts. We use them, but we do not see them as fixed realities. In other words, they have no self. Something presents, appears, but it doesn't stand outside with a separated set of characteristics. So, there's another section I want to read here. So this is section 10, and this also goes into this. Setting forth pure lands, Pure land. So pure land would be this land of awakening, of deep enlightenment. So this pure land, away from the passions of desire, hatred, anger, all the impurities of mind which arise in ordinary life. So this is setting forth pure lands. And the Buddha said, Subhuti, what do you think? In the remote past, when the Tathagata was with Dipankara Buddha, did he have any degree of attainment in the good law? No world-honored one. It's amazing. No world-honored one. He's talking to the Buddha. Did I have any attainment in the good law? No world-honored one. When the Tathagata, incidentally, that's another appellation of Buddha, which means one who has gone thus, one who has gone thus. When the Tathagata was with Dipankara Buddha, he had no degree of attainment in the good law. Subhuti, what do you think? Does a bodhisattva set forth any majestic Buddha lands? No world-honored one. Wherefore? Because setting forth majestic Buddha lands is not a majestic setting forth. This is merely a name. Then Buddha continued, therefore, Subhuti, all bodhisattvas, lesser and greater, should develop a pure, lucid mind, not depending upon sound, flavor, touch, odor, or any quality, not depending on these in any way. A bodhisattva should develop a mind which alights upon no thing whatsoever. There's another way that this is translated. Develop a mind that abides nowhere, that gets stuck nowhere, that attaches to no specific idea, concept, belief, name, selfness. And so should he establish it. Subhuti, this may be likened to a human frame as large as the mighty Mount Sumeru. What do you think? Would such a body be great? Now, Mount Sumeru is this mythical mountain in Buddhist iconography that sits at the center of the universe, and it's massive. Subhuti replied, great indeed, world-honored one. This is because Buddha has explained that no body is called a great body. No body. It's called a great body. No identification with a body, with a separate self, with characteristics, with the sense of being apart, being a fixed thing, having no concept of that, is to have a great body, a massive body, no borders, no edges, extending out into infinity. Everywhere you look, everything is your body. Everything is in your center. If it was not in your center, it could not be. For something to be means it is known by you. It is because it is known in your center. This is that incredible, miraculous, mind-blowing achievement that you automatically have, intrinsically have. You were born with it. It's your birthright. It's spread throughout all of existence. When Moses asked God, what is your name? God answered, I am that I am, that I am. Someone on his enlightenment said, just to be is a total act. Just to be is a total act. How could that be achieved? And how mysterious and incredible that there is anything at all. And that there is means it is you. It is in your center. It could not be without you. Nothing can be without you. Therefore, there is no self. There's no border between things. There's no thing out there. There's no entity standing apart in here. It's only called an entity. If it was an entity, we couldn't call it an entity. It wouldn't know of anything outside itself, and we'd have no concepts. So I'm sure that I've mystified everybody. I've utterly failed. But I think to create a stretching like this is actually a good thing. So the main thing to get is that in your practice, we pick up one thing, we see it clearly, we go deep with it, we watch it closely, be it the count of your breath, be it the actual breath, be it the flow of the moment in Shikantaza, or be it a koan, a single thought sound, plunging into that thought sound all the way to the bottom. You realize, you get it, gradually it becomes obvious that this is my mu. There's not one iota of this outside me. This is my breath, this breath. This breath, only I know it. So where does it end and I begin? And how can I call it breath if there's no border between it and me? How can I define it that way? And is there any separation between that and the smell of incense coming in? And all these things, this panoply of experience in my center. What is its essence? What is it made of? This is the profound question in Zazen. This is that penetrating Zazen. Once we break through the surface of our thinking minds that are very scattered and develop this one-pointedness, which takes time and requires patience, and which even a very experienced Zazen practitioner has to continually work with. And once we let go of our concepts about things being separated entities, this being fixed, out there, real, solid, dividing lines, characteristics that separate this thing from that thing, we become very dispassionate about these things. And then we are able to go into the heart of it. We see that not one tiny iota of anything that I experience in my Zazen can possibly be outside my deepest center. Only I know it. It is absolutely intimate to me. It's like in the koan Joshu's Mu. This point at which your experience in working on Mu becomes, shades into awakening. Mumon described this state as, it's like a person who's drinking water. Only that person knows for themselves whether it is hot or cold. It's that intimate. So this is the direction to move in your Zazen, to understand this third mark of existence, this no separated selfness. No separated selfness. Okay, so we'll end there tonight.